I've decided I'm going to create a new word.
The campaign is based on that power of not finger swiping.
And in this day and age, I think you've got to applaud Twitter because there's so much sameness out there.
The thing that most business owners strive to achieve is the very thing that holds them back.
It's Wednesday, 18th of October, 2017, and welcome to the Simon Dell Podcast, Episode 3. Now, the dream of many business owners is to eventually sell their concern for a hefty ton of money and retire comfortably. It might be that they don't want to retire, but they want to start another business or follow a philanthropic route. But for all those business owners with their eye on the prize, there are equally as many, if not more, that don't have an exit strategy and might keep on working until they simply can't work anymore. Today we talked to Simon Bell, and while Simon might have a very similar name to mine, his approach to business has been markedly different. And at 34, he's recently sold a startup business that he created just 3 years ago. We'll find out why he entered into what was already a busy marketplace, how he scaled it up so quickly, and what eventually convinced him to exit after just 3 years. He'll also tell us about a key failure earlier in his business life that shaped what he's done in the past 10 years. And he'll provide some excellent ideas, thoughts, and direction about how to improve your business. This is one not to miss. As well as our feature interview, we'll talk to our usual motley band of co-hosts, Edwina Luck and Patrick Condren, and discuss inventing new words, colour dots in advertising, and going back in time with Etch-A-Sketch. This is the Simon Dell Podcast, and welcome. Welcome to another edition of The Spin Cycle. And with me this evening, we have our two guests. We have the iPhone X of guests with Dr. Edwina Luck. And we also have the Nokia banana phone of guests, Patrick Condren. So welcome, you two.
I knew you were going to say that. The minute you introduced Ed as the iPhone X, I knew I was going to get the Nokia. They're making a comeback.
Did you ever have a Nokia banana phone?
What's a Nokia banana phone? I don't know.
It was the one that you click the you press the button on the side and it shot downwards into a mouthpiece.
No, I only had the flip.
I can't remember what the number it was, but
it sounds like a number two, to be honest. And I meant that in every sense of the colloquialism.
On that note, why don't we start with your with your choice? What have you seen this week, young Patrick?
I think this is fantastic, and it's a fantastic use of the print media.
Ooh.
Because a lot of the stuff that we talk about or have been talking about revolves around electronics and clever electronic stuff. Mm. So what they did, this Irish Wi-Fi provider, what they convinced the Daily Mail magazine to do is to replace all their black dots, so their full stops, the dots above the eyes, every dot, every black dot in the magazine would be replaced with a coloured dot.
Hmm.
And at the end of the magazine, there's a full-page ad with a big black circle, and in white writing it says, no more black spots. At this particular company, we don't like black spots, which is why we've gotten rid of them in this magazine. Yeah. And we can get rid of them in your home and office too with Wi-Fi calling. And I think that is absolutely fantastic. It's clever. Mm. It's an original idea. I can't remember ever seeing it being done before. And what makes it even better is that they, a bit like J.K. Rowling, they went around to a whole lot of publishers to try and convince them. This is the advertisers,
right, okay,
to try and to convince them to do this. Mm-hmm. And a lot of them said no, until they got to the Daily Mail. And it was one of their weekend newspaper lift outs. I think it's just clever.
Clever.
Because from the beginning, you'd have bought the magazine, you'd be looking at it, you'd be thinking, why? What's with all the coloured dots? Mm. And it's like a story, and at the end, it's all revealed. I think it's really clever, really clever. It's something I would have thought of.
Well, it would have cost a lot.
What do you reckon, Eddie?
Yeah, well, it would have cost a lot with the coloured dots for sure. But, Pat, was this a new company, like an incoming that is trying to enter into the market?
No, they've been around for a while by all accounts. Mm. Rothko is their name.
Mm-hmm.
And they've described it as an elaborate stunt. And it was in a 12-page pull-out magazine, even on the front page.
Wow.
The magazine bit, the lift-out bit is called It's Friday. So the I in the It's is blue and the exclamation mark at the end, the dot beneath that, yeah. is pink.
Yes, I saw that cover, and Harrison Ford looked as bemused as the dots, because it was advertising the new movie for
Blade Runner. It's called.
Yeah, that's the one. Yeah.
Just for everyone's benefit, we'll share all these images on our brand new Instagram account,
yes.
so that people can actually see what we're talking about on this. So.
But I think it's just clever. I think it's just clever because you know from the very beginning you're looking at it, you're thinking, what's with the dots? Mm. And I can just imagine flicking through it and then noticing that in every sentence all the dots, all the black dots have been replaced. And then there's the reveal at the end, and it's a perfect use for that medium. It's not like it was a general advertising pitch that crossed all different media.
No, it's a great...
This was specifically for print.
I don't know. Simon, I'll definitely get your opinion soon, but because you asked me
you
for
have
mine.
To?
Yeah, I think we should. But, you know, you called this a stunt, and, out of print, you have guerrilla marketing. In a sense, this is a type of guerrilla in print. I don't know. What do you think of it, Simon?
Yeah. No, I really like it. I think it's as Patrick said, it's going to make you think all the way through until you get to the end. And I think great advertising is, as we all know, great advertising makes you stops and interrupts your train of thought, and it makes you think, and then it reinforces it right at the end there with that great message. It's a great piece. Mm. I wouldn't be surprised if that's going to put itself up for a few awards and some of the big, the old Cannes Lions. Mm. So
I think it's clever.
Well,
and in this day and age, I think you've got to applaud clever because there's so much sameness out there.
Well, print. Yes.
And people just reinventing the wheel almost.
Well, print can be very creative and so can outdoor. So why don't we go from island?
Well, what a segue. It's almost like we've done this before, but go for it.
Yeah, so let's go from island to New York, where Toys R Us have got this amazing pop-up in the New York subway with a giant Etch-a-Sketch. Now, do you remember those growing up, boys?
Not personally, because we were dirt poor, so we used to do the same thing
in the dirt
with a stick. But certainly my kids have enjoyed it, have enjoyed them through the years. And, in fact, when the kids went to sleep, I'd often have a little go.
Oh, very nice. Well, I remember I bought one for my children probably 18 years ago. But this is really interesting. So BBDO in New York have created this installation, and I know you're going to ask me how old is Etch-a-Sketch?
How old is Etch-a-Sketch?
He's been on the wine again.
I haven't. I'm on the wagon.
The McGuigans from last week.
I'm on the wagon.
Are you doing? Anywho, it's 50.
No.
They are 56 years old.
And, wow, really?
Totally amazing, especially when you consider that this toy, and toy I suppose is a word that you would use in inverted commas. It doesn't connect to Wi-Fi. It doesn't have Bluetooth. There are no batteries, but it continues to be relevant and iconic. And so, you know, you're going to work or you're coming home and you can have a bit of de-stress. The nostalgia is there. I just think it's incredible that they've done this installation.
I can guarantee that if my little 17-month-old got hold of this, the first thing he would do is try and swipe his finger across the screen.
Well, it's interesting you say that because the campaign is based on that power of not finger swiping, but it's about the power of play.
Yeah. I always found Etch-a-Sketch it was just so hard.
There is neither surprise nor anything else on Ed and my face.
No, it's needlessly complicated in my mind. No, I had one, but I never enjoyed it at all. It just something about it. It's like a Rubik's cube.
Actually, I must admit,
there's a bit of grimness about that.
What? That I never enjoyed Etch-a-Sketch.
Yeah. Have you got your one for your little boy?
No, I'm not getting him an Etch-a-Sketch. He keeps trying to swipe on the iPad already when he's watching The Wiggles.
Oh, so it's two-screening?
Yeah.
Wow.
No, no, he watches the Wiggles on the iPad, not on the TV, and has the iPad at the same time. We've not gone, you know, and he only gets half an hour a day. So we're, you know, we're trying to restrict it a little bit.
Yeah. Well, play comes in all different forms, and and it's a, whether it's an installation in New York subway, and then you go down to Toys R Us down in Times Square, or you're in downtown Brisbane and playing at home in your lounge room.
I think it's a fantastic idea, and it's interesting because Toys R Us, if I remember rightly, and I'm not going to be able to find the information now, but Toys R Us are in a bit of trouble in it.
They are in a bit of trouble.
They filed for bankruptcy, actually, Simon. You are exactly right.
So this is interesting that that's happened just at the same time as they've done this. So. Well, it's a big shame.
Yeah, the campaign, they have actually been in trouble before, and the campaign was designed and created before they filed for bankruptcy.
Yeah.
But it's obviously become a bit more urgent now, and hopefully it's going to boost sales because it's going to play on that factor of nostalgia and experiential. So hopefully it works for them.
Well, I think there's two excellent creative ideas there in the dots and the Etch-a-Sketch. And for my one this week, I've decided I'm going to create a new word.
Ooh.
Right?
I love it.
I know I can. Do you know what I can hear?
Is it a sweary word?
No, no, it's not. I can hear the excitement in your voice there, Patrick.
Did you hear that? I heard that too.
and I'm going to create. And do you know what? I know I'm going to create it because I tried to find the hashtag on Instagram and it doesn't exist. So therefore,
wow. Have you tried a dictionary?
Old school.
I'm fairly confident this word does not exist in the dictionary.
Now,
Sorry?
Do we need a drum roll? This is exciting.
Well, do you want to do it?
No.
Go for it.
No, we haven't got time.
We haven't got time.
What sort of a drum is that?
That's not a drum.
Sound like a crashing helicopter.
Wow.
The word is exaggersplaining.
Oh, my God.
Oh, nice and
God.
Simple word. How are you spelling it?
I love it already.
Exagger, as in the start of exaggerate.
That's not telling me how to spell it. That's just re-pronouncing it.
Hold on.
When you talk to someone in a foreign language, you just keep getting louder in the hope that they're going to understand you.
E-X-A-G-G-E-R. Are you writing this down? E-X-A-G-G-E-R.
Yep.
And then splaining, S-P-L-A-I-N. ING.
Yes.
Exaggersplaining.
I exaggersplain all the time and I haven't even heard your definition.
Do you know what a lot of people do?
Okay. I've got to tell you. So I've looked up, I've Googled I can't even pronounce it. That's such
exaggersplaining.
Exaggersplaining. And Google can't find any reference to it. Oh, there's a photo. It says stupid word. And there's a photo of Simon Dell. That's the only reference there is to it on the internet.
There you go. So we're going to create history here, and I want to explain this. And you might not want to hear this. You might not want this image in your head. But I was in the shower the other day, and I was reading the back of the shower gel that I have in the shower.
Oh yes,
and it's
you don't need glasses. I like that.
It's Radox. It's a Radox.
Not for some things.
It's a Radox shower gel. And I'm just going to read the explanation of the product on the back of the bottle. It says, Radox, how do you want to feel? Wake up and smell the sea salt. Say yes to punchy sea minerals and no to boring limits and excuses. Dive in today wholeheartedly.
Hmm.
Now, that to me is exaggersplaining. Because it's explaining to me what the product does, but it is an absolutely ridiculous exaggeration.
I think you'll
what
find.
The product does.
I think you'll find that comes under a generic title of advertising.
Yes, exactly. I was thinking of CK1 when they came out with that. But yes, the same. I love it. I love it. Verbiage.
Well, I'm just.
It's why just would this, they say? Why would they go into that much? Verbal diarrhea.
Because they're exaggerating the benefits of a shower gel.
But does anyone ever read it? I mean, you were probably.
Yes.
Pardon?
Absolutely. People love that sort of stuff. Because it's.
Who are these people?
People love escapism. They love.
Turn them up. Push them over a cliff. Why do we need these people in our lives? I don't get it.
I think this is probably not the only example of exaggersplaining.
So we can find some.
I'm going to keep pushing this word because Because yes, well, I'll appear on Google Trends. Or
I love
something,
it. I'll find you some other ones, Simon, for sure.
Well, we're saving them up for next week, Eddie. Maybe we ought to have an exagersplaining every week.
We should, every week. Yes.
Or we could boil our heads in oil.
See, he's exagersplaining.
Yeah, he is.
I'm not exagersplaining. I'm pointing out a real possibility for people sitting down listening to you two talk about exagersplaining.
And they're laughing you and going, Simon and Edwina really know their stuff.
Again, put them with the herd of people, push them over the cliff.
And they're sitting there thinking, who's the cranky bloke
they've got in the background?
He's
a pessimist.
By creating a new word called exagersplaining,
yes,
you are in fact... Exagersplaining. No.
There you go.
But
because there's no need for a new word.
Yes, there is.
We've got a number of perfectly usable words, as I said earlier. Advertising, bullshit, crap, codswallop.
Grumpy old
there's
man.
There's a whole lot of words.
The beauty of the word is it by itself is its own definition.
Absolutely.
That's the beauty.
I'm going to crack some champagne on that one, I think, Simon, because I love it. So,
well, I don't think it's not going to be the last time that we hear of this word. I'm going to make sure we hashtag that on Instagram, which means that will be the very first time that it appears on Instagram. Good. And therefore is written into the English language. I'm sure that's how it works, isn't it? As soon as a hashtag.
And now what is the
Instagram.
Twitter handle?
It is the Simon Dell Podcast.
Oh, we don't even get a mention.
Well, I ran out of characters. I hurriedly put
that
one
up
there. Yeah.
He's nothing. He's just exagersplaining into the ionosphere.
I think it's probably about time that we wound this up because, we could be here all night otherwise. So once again, thank you for your dots. Thank you for your Etch-a-Sketch. And I hope you enjoyed a healthy dose of exagersplaining. And we'll catch up with you two again next week.
Have a great week.
See that goodbye was exagersplaining. You could have just said goodbye.
So it's not often that I meet other people called Simon. There's not many of us out there in the world, and it's even rarer to meet somebody with a surname that's almost identical to myself. But I met this gentleman several years ago. I can't remember how long ago now. And I think he's got a fascinating story. So welcome, Simon Bell.
Thank you, Simon Dell. Thanks for having me.
How are you doing?
Great, mate. Great to be here.
Well, look, we'll get right into it because I just want to get you to give us a little bit of your background, how you got to where you are today, just in, just top line stuff. So just so people can understand what you've been doing.
Yeah, fantastic. It's been a journey. It's been a big 10 years. So it's 10 years in business. Started off selling cars, believe it or not. Don't hold that against me. started out as one of the youngest licensed car dealers in Queensland and started as a backyarder. I knew nothing about business in the early days. Absolutely diddly squat. I knew how to sell. And so I just, my car seemed like an obvious kind of progression or obvious starting point.
Yeah.
And just bought and sold and bought and sold and bought and sold and, turned three cars into about 30 cars in 12 months. And that kind of started the business journey. It started a finance company which attached itself to the car yard called Carbucks, which is a bit of a play on words with Starbucks.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice.
When Starbucks first kind of hit the scene.
You never managed to get yourself a cease and desist letter from
that was my mission, but never achieved that objective.
Just didn't quite make the notoriety.
It wasn't big enough. That's right. Exactly. And a clothing shop in the early days just to mix things up a little bit.
Yeah. Well, come back to the clothing shop in a minute because I know there's quite a good story about that.
Mm. And then did some coaching. I've been coaching small business owners for the last 8 years as well as building a business. We've just exited from a startup that I launched with a business partner 3 years ago called Staffberry. And so that's been the journey in a nutshell.
And here you are now.
And here I am now.
I just want to quickly go back to the car yard story because I think the car industry is one that's been relatively immune to the changes, you know, the innovation and the changes that have been happening in the sort of the last 10 to 15 years. I perceive that it's been fairly immune to it, and you might think differently. But I think it's going to undergo quite a radical change within the next 5 to 10 years. What are your thoughts around that?
I think it will. I think it's starting to. The days of big car yards, I think, are numbered. Although they seem to be investing a lot of money into dealerships still, which, you know, obviously, well, maybe, I'm not going to say obviously, but maybe people a lot smarter than me know more than I do about the future of that industry. But, you know, I just think with the locations of these dealerships and with the price of property, you know, I don't see it too far in the future where it's transitions into somewhere like Tokyo. If you ever go to Tokyo or anywhere in Japan, the dealerships are more like showrooms where they have interactive kind of screens, and you book a test drive, you know, in a track somewhere, dealership run, so to speak. But, you know, who knows? It's there's been some transition in the way people are marketing.
Yeah.
Dealers are marketing. You know, they're using a lot more social, a lot more, when I say a lot more, they're probably still 10 years behind the average industry. But I think it's time. I don't think their immunity is going to last forever.
No, it feels like, I spoke last week about magazine publishing and about print media and how that was like a very, very slow car crash. And, you know, and no sort of pun intended, but, you know, perhaps the same thing's going to happen with the dealerships. Is all of a sudden they're going to find themselves, you know, like with a lot of retailers, with huge square meters of car yard that they simply can't afford to keep paying for.
That's right. And don't necessarily need, I don't think.
No. It's funny how that's still a thing out there. And I think you know, car dealers and I think service stations as well, if we all start moving to electric cars and self-driving cars, you know, we're going to need service stations less and parking as well.
Yeah. I mean, you see it. You see, I mean, I was walking through Garden City the other day. I think it was Garden City. And there's one at Carindale as well. There's little, I suppose you'd call them car dealerships. I mean, little showrooms inside of a Westfield.
Yeah.
And I think that's going to be the trend. Yeah.
So clothing, what on earth took you into the clothing business?
And skateboards and skateboards. Gear, I know.
Can you skate?
Not at all. No, never. No.
So it was obviously a passion skating for tragic. Not being able to skate.
That's right.
That took you into skateboard clothing.
Opportunity. Right. You know, I had an entrepreneurial seizure, as Michael Gerber puts it. It was a good friend of mine, one of my best mates, his idea. He was living down south. He was living in Gosford at the time, Central Coast, New South Wales. And he had this idea of starting a skate shop in the Redlands. There was no skate shops there at the time. And, you know, business was good. Car yard was good. Finance was good. So I was young and naive and ego-driven and cashed up. And
all terrible things.
all terrible things
to start business.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Hindsight is a beautiful thing.
It's the only exact science, as my father used to say.
That's right. He pitched this idea to me over the phone. He said, I'm moving back to Brisbane. On a certain day, I can't remember, but I think it was in September. And so I flew to Newcastle and drove back to Brisbane with him with his panel van packed full of his gear. And we put a business plan in the car overnight on the drive home. And 2 weeks later, we rented a place and opened a shop called Against the Grain.
Wow.
And so started with, as all, you know, there's a particular theme of my businesses. They're all bootstrapped.
All good small businesses.
That's right. Makes you resourceful.
Yeah.
And we experienced some great growth in the first 2 to 3 years. But unfortunately, and I think I've shared this story with you, Simon, that we had a particular demographic that preferred not to pay for stock than pay for it.
Yeah.
And we actually got broken into 6 times in 12 months in 2008. So
what happens after you've been broken into the third time? Do you did you just sort of resign yourself to the fact that people were going to break in, or were you buying more sophisticated security systems, or what goes through your head at that point?
Yeah, a lot. Dreading a private phone call at in the evening. That was always always a challenge. But look, every time we got broken into, we upped the ante. But there's only so much.
Yeah.
You can take mentally, you know, in that period of time to kind of start to get resigned. And I definitely wasn't as mentally tough as I am today. So I hadn't done any work on myself at that stage. I think this was probably the catalyst for me to go and do a bit of a deep dive on Simon Bell as an individual and as an entrepreneur. So,
yeah.
I think it was a blessing in disguise. It didn't occur like that at the time. No. I can assure you.
Of course not. No.
But yeah, it was challenging because, you know, the money that we'd accrued, that I'd accrued in the other businesses, was very quickly getting sucked up in that venture.
And what was the sort of straw that broke the camel's back, with the sort of day you just went, nah, forget this, I'm out of this?
Yeah, I think it was a culmination. I think it was I did a personal development program in, this all happened in 2008. I did a personal development program in September of 2008. And it really shifted the way in which I viewed the world and myself, and you know, I got to fess up as to how much of an arrogant jerk I'd been. And it was kind of like, it gave me the courage then to get in communication. I think the only thing that was keeping us there was the lease. We're kind of just surviving the last, you know, 6 months. So I got inspired to have a conversation with the landlord, and he was great. He was really great, actually. And so what we did is, we negotiated an early release from the lease, and it was it. We managed to sell all of our stock. Interestingly enough, it was kind of, I think I've shared this with you, I think I called it the Gallipoli retreat.
Right.
It was the most successful part of the entire operation.
Yeah, was getting out of it.
Was getting out of it, yeah. We sold our stock. We had a few exclusive brands that we imported into the country,
right,
which we were able to sell the rights to. And it wasn't, It was almost a break even for me after all that. Okay. It wasn't quite, but it almost came through.
There wasn't a point in that exit where you were sort of going, well, actually, perhaps this could work. And there wasn't the temptation to sort of turn around and keep going again?
Nah, mentally checked out. Mentally. And, you know, look, my business partner, who, as I said, is a great friend, still is a great friend.
Yep.
And it had a major impact on him. He was the operations, like he was on the floor, on the ground day to day. And so, you know, coming into the shop, you know, especially post break in and that sort of thing, you know, it had a big mental impact on him. And so he was, you know, it was time for him to move on and you know, rebuild himself and move on to greener pastures as well. So
there's a point you just mentioned there about you had exclusive rights to some imported brands.
Mm.
And that's one of the things I often say to people when you're sort of building a marketing strategy for people, is that if you can get something in your business that only you have and nobody else, no competitors, that really sort of stands you out and gives you that sort of competitive edge in certain areas. Was that something you did deliberately at that time, or was that it just sort of happened that you'd found these brands and you weren't really thinking in that kind of way at the time?
No, I'd like to say that it was strategic, but it wasn't. Look, it may have been my business partner, he organized that.
Yeah.
It may have actually been. It definitely didn't come across that way, but I'd like to say that it was all my entrepreneurial genius. But
so from the clothing store, you went into business coaching.
Yeah.
Was that a direct line, or was there you kind of ummed and ahed for a bit, and or you just went, you know what, I've got something to teach people? And
yeah, well, I think that's usually what business coaches do. You know, after a failure, they go and tell people what not to do. So
Don't do as I say. Yeah.
That's exactly. No. So it was I think once again doing that work on myself kind of had me, and I say that, I kind of say it with jest, but I don't, I actually do mean it. Like I got present to how much ego was running the show in business and how much, you know, about looking, it was all about looking good and building something that, you know, that wasn't really a passion for me. I mean, I had this moment where I woke up and I was like, oh my God, I'm a car dealer. You know, how, and no, no offense to car dealers listening potentially, obviously, but it was kind of, wasn't the you know, the game plan when I was growing up, obviously, but, I just got how much, I wanted to contribute to other people, and that's where I found true happiness and fulfillment is in contribution. And so, I actually did a business course, and I was talking to my coach, and I said to her, look, I'm kind of in this transition period where we're selling the shop, you know, selling the stock, closing that down. I don't want to be a car dealer anymore. I don't necessarily want to be in the finance game. Yeah. I want to give back. I want to contribute. And it was her recommendation. She said, you know, I think you'd make an amazing, you've got an amazing story. You've been through some amazing challenges. Have you ever thought about coaching? And so that was, you know, March 2009. And, I haven't looked back. You know, I went through all of those phases, as we all do in any business, I think, as you know, I don't think I can do this. You know, who am I to say? I feel like a fraud, da-da-da. But, you know, we had some amazing successes in the car yard. We had some amazing initial successes in the clothing shop as well. So, and I think having both the peaks and the troughs allowed me to be real with people and you know, empathize when people are dealing with the challenges that they're dealing with. And I haven't looked back. I love contributing to, especially to small business owners. It's a passion of mine.
So on that note, you went into the business coaching. How long did you do that for?
So I've been coaching for 9 years.
Oh, you're still doing it, but
yeah, you know, still doing a little bit of coaching. Yeah.
What, I mean, with 9 years of business coaching, you must've seen some interesting businesses, some interesting people, and both challenging people and challenging situations. Mm. Give us a couple that sort of really stood out from you, and they may be ones that have been successful, they might be ones that have been failures, but ones that, you know, you've learned from as well as obviously the owner of the business learning from.
So there's one that stands out just off the top of my head is a lady on the Gold Coast who owns a company that services children with disabilities, and it was a challenge in the early stages because she had this beautiful message and this beautiful commitment. She had a child with a disability, and you know, you could see that this was a very personal business, and you know, what was challenging was that you know, at the time there was very little support, you know, on a personal level. And also that combined with, you know, I suppose a lack of confidence in her own ability as an entrepreneur, or as a business owner. So, you know, I don't know, it's interesting because it started off as a challenge, but probably ended up one of the greatest success stories, that I'd seen in coaching. You know, she started in the front room of her house, you know, selling stuff out the back of a truck to, you know, she now owns two commercial properties, you know, a bus, you know, does amazing things with charity and, you know, is an absolute success story. So I think it was challenging wise, I think with any of the coaching, the biggest challenge is dealing with people's identity and ego, and you know, and working with them around, you know, maybe giving up some limiting beliefs for themselves.
Yeah. And how did she? I mean, when you first met her, was there a sort of a vision in her for success for her? Did she go, right, well, here's where I want to get to, or was she just sort of saying, was she kind of learning that day by day, and every step was taking her forward, but she wasn't quite sure where she wanted to get to?
I think it rapidly evolved as she started to see some success.
Yeah.
There was definitely it's interesting. It's an interesting point, this, you know, vision for a company. You know, have people traditionally talk about vision for a company as far as size of company or growth of company, growth rate. And they talk very strategically, very, very, you know, very much from the management perspective. There was never any doubt in her mind about the commitment that she had and the impact that she wanted to have on the world. And I think that, I think the rest follows suit.
Yeah.
You know, you're talking about having that vision. I think people collapse vision for a company with its strategic objectives as opposed to, you know, that core purpose.
Yeah.
So that never changed. I think just as she grew and learnt more about business and what was possible, you know, the pieces of the puzzle sort of started to come together.
You also talked about limiting behaviors just then. And obviously that's something that, you know, something that I find myself very familiar with in the last couple of years as you start to sort of take an objective look at yourself. What are some of the common limiting behaviors that you've seen in that sort of small business space, those owners and those, you know, startups or people that have been in business for a long time and still have those behaviors?
That's a good question. It is case by case. I mean, if you wanted to talk kind of themes of limiting behaviors, because obviously everybody's individuals different, the beliefs are different, but anything where you can say, you know, oh, I'm not good at X, you know, or I suck at X or whatever that might be. So like it could be, you know, common one is, I'm not good with money. I'm not good with finances.
Right.
So I, you know, and they therefore abdicate, you know, their understanding of financial management, or, you know, they abdicate and not delegate, they just abdicate as far as like this is for someone else to manage. Because I'm not good with, you know, with numbers or money or dollars or whatever it is, or math, which is basically just, you know, some belief or opinion they've formulated about themselves from school or high school or, you know, whatever it might be. And that's just, you know, manifest and they've found more evidence for it. And it's just, you know, become their truth. Marketing's a good one too. I'm not good with marketing.
I hear that a lot, and that, as soon as they say it, then they have immediately, exactly as you say, abdicated any responsibility for marketing. It's down the bottom of the pile, and everything else suddenly becomes more important than marketing. In the reality is that's the only thing that's going to bring new people into the business.
Totally.
And they don't have to be good at it, you know, they don't have to enjoy it, but they have to understand it and either get someone else to help them or, you know, those kind of things.
Totally, totally. And then, you know, and then there's the more personal limiting beliefs, you know, around success and, you know, personal wealth and, you know, being worth it. And, you know, it's, you know, for the average person that has never done any, you know, reflection or work on themselves, it's fundamentally just their inner five-year-olds running the show. Yeah. And that's not to diminish any of anybody, but that's, you know, just the reality of the situation. Yeah.
I think one of the things I wanted to touch on around limiting behaviors there was something that obviously you and I have spoken about in the past is the tendency that I certainly have. And, you know, I think you've sort of acknowledged that you have the same, perhaps a little more controlled than mine, but that kind of, oh, look, there's a new shiny idea thing. I don't know how we'd actually refer to that, but, you know, I've met lots of people in the past. We've got friends in common who have who've had the same traits and those kind of things. And, you know, and I think they would be the first to acknowledge that or, you know, that they may have been like that in the past, but they've learned to control it. That shiny new object is a limiting behavior. And last time we spoke, you kind of spoke about how you controlled that, or at least how you dealt with that issue. So was it an issue? And again, how did you deal with it?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it is a challenge. I think focus is one of the most important factors of building any successful business. And I refer to it as entrepreneurial ADD.
That's a better explanation than shiny new thing.
Well, it is. It's just, you know, the new idea. And, you know, as a coach and just being, and as someone that's whose brain is constantly in that entrepreneurial space and, you know, you see opportunities as you do, it's very easy to come up with ideas and come up with amazing ideas. And, you know, there's always that internal battle of this could actually be the next idea. This could be an amazing idea. This could be the greatest idea ever, you know, the Uber of. But look, I think if you're working on a project and you're listening to this and you kind of experience that You know, that entrepreneurial ADD where you're bouncing from, or you're always looking for the next thing. Have a look at the thing that you're doing and see whether you're actually getting fulfillment from that. I think that's probably the biggest question. Not to say that you, even if you did have fulfillment, that you wouldn't look around, but, you know, I think it's important. And this really comes back to a couple of things. FOMO, the old fear of missing out. Absolutely. That's just drives. And that is a fear. That's a fundamental fear. So it is a limiting belief.
And anyone who says that it's just a Gen Y thing or a millennial thing, it goes with you throughout the whole of your life, irrespective of whether you're 18 or you're 43. It changes into, you know, not going to festivals versus missing out on a business opportunity, but
that's right.
It still exists.
I think the difference, you know, you talk about being a gen, people say it's Gen Y versus, you know, didn't show up as much, you know, in the previous generations. Well, that's because I think they were just resigned to the fact that they had one job and that was it for the rest of their life. Yeah. You know, like there wasn't as much opportunity there. And so now we're in an environment where, you know, we've got these amazing opportunities and there's never been a better time to be in business, to start a business, to launch a business because of technology and, you know, my background in offshore human resources, you know, the ability to be able to outsource, you know, your barrier to entry to building a great team these days is so much, you know, smaller. So I think there's that. And then, so that's a fear of missing out. But I think when you've found something that genuinely fulfills you, you know, you've got a purpose that fulfills you, it's a lot easier to control. I'm not saying it's not going to be there, but it's a lot easier to say, no, this is my focus. This is my passion. This is what I'm working on and working towards. And, you know, you and I have had this conversation. Yeah. And as much as it's challenging and hard to say no, reward is on the other side of that. So it's a learnt, if you're suffering from entrepreneurial ADD, it is a learnt skill to resist. It takes discipline. But
it's interesting because after the conversation you and I had a few weeks back, I've started reading a book called, a book by a guy called Cal Newport, called So Good They Can't Ignore You. I don't know if you've read that, but one of the things he actually says is the follow your passion belief is actually a fallacy and you shouldn't do that. And it's actually incredibly damaging to do that. And what you should be doing is, in essence, I'll summarize the whole book in a paragraph here, but in essence, he's saying that the craftsmanship approach is the better approach to take, to get really, really good at what you do. And then as you get good at what you do, you will become more passionate about it and you will enjoy it more. So it's the craftsmanship comes first, the passion comes after. Whereas a lot of what people talk about is to say, you know, follow your passion. And he uses some great examples where, you know, people have quit their, you know, six-figure jobs and started a yoga school and then gone bust within 12 months because they don't have the experience and the capital in themselves in a yoga school that they did in their previous role. So it's interesting that there's those kind of different, you know, different viewpoints. And I think the danger is that if you want to jump from, if you've got that entrepreneurial ADD, that's not necessarily a bad thing. If you're staying within a particular sector that you already have experience in, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah. Like I think from that, and that's an interesting point that he makes there around craftsmanship first and then passion follows. I think it's an interesting, because I never actually subscribed to, and I don't know whether I think passion's an overused word in this context, because it's, I think for the average person thinking about what is passion, it's a very conceptual word. You know, they relate to passion, not necessarily in a business context. It's interesting. I think if you actually go and do the work on yourself to find out, you know, what truly fulfills you and what your values are, and then craft a commitment around that. So for example, you know, I for the last 9 years and to this day, and I don't see it changing anytime in the future, I do have a genuine commitment to contributing. And contributing to entrepreneurs and small business owners, I mean, that was the core of why Staffberry launched. because it was, you know, for me, it was the number one challenge that I saw in the coaching space for small business owners was time. You know, people having the time to do the things that truly mattered to them, whether that was to continue to grow their business, scale their business, or to spend time with their family. So once you find that core, you know, purpose, the vehicle then, I tend to agree with your author there as far as, you know, you then can build a level of skill and you know, expertise around the technical components of the vehicle, because the vehicle then doesn't really matter because as long as it's fulfilling your values and fulfilling your purpose, at the risk of sounding all airy fairy, but as long as it's fulfilling that, you'll find happiness and in turn you'll go the extra mile. You'll do the things that most people won't do. And I just think, to sum all that up, I think you're right. I think the term passion has been overused and it's lost its meaning. So I think as long as you find that's the other thing too. Most people start businesses based on ego and identity, or things that they think society, you know, or their parents or their teachers or whatever it might be, social pressures, said that they're really good at and they should go and do this. And so they go and start these businesses and when in actual fact, they've got it's not fulfilling their purpose in life. They're not fulfilled, but they're going through the motions and they wonder why it occurs as hard work.
Mm. So you mentioned Staffberry there. You launched that just over 3 years ago. You launched it in what I perceived at the time was to be a very crowded marketplace. A lot of people doing similar types of thing or almost exactly the same sort of thing. How did talk about some of the challenges that you faced there and about how you made yourself stand out in that marketplace?
Yeah. It's interesting you should say that because it's, I'm a action first, think later kind of guy, which sometimes works and sometimes is my downfall. It came out of an opportunity. I think I had a disadvantage, an unfair advantage, I should say, not a disadvantage, an unfair advantage in that I had immersed myself in my market for so long, in that small business space. And intimately, I'd worked with over 1,000 businesses in the last 8 years and heard the warts and all stories. And so, I'd had a virtual assistant for a couple of years before that, off and on prior to that, 3 or 4 years. Yep. And I just happened to be sharing with one of the groups I was leading about DJ. I'll say the name. Some of you who are probably listening have heard DJ if you've got an assistant through Staffberry. The feedback was, well, how do we get a DJ? And it was just a great opportunity. Yeah. That we got DJ to find some friends, and it was really that beginner. Yeah. And I remember walking out of the class and saying to Jess, my business partner, who wasn't my business partner at the time, but she became a business partner. I just said, look, there's a business in this. Yeah. And you're right. Look, as the business evolved, I then discovered that there was a lot more competition to it. But what I think, to answer your question, they're all the same. Mm. You made the point there. They were all the same. Yeah. And to be quite honest, that they were boring. I said when we were creating the brand, and this is something that, I'm sure we'll dig a little bit deeper on, but when we're creating the branding, I made it very clear that if I saw a Filipino with a headset on giving the thumbs up, looking at the camera in any of the marketing collateral, someone's head was going to roll.
Yeah. Yeah.
If you see the brand, it's colorful, bright, it's fun. And I wanted to make sure that we did it different. And we were that at the core of what we did was to contribute and allow business owners to buy back the time to focus on the things that truly matter. And I've said that before, and that sounds like a party line, but that's truly what the company believes in and what I still believe in, even post exit.
It's interesting because looking at it from a casual observer from the outside, your personality really sort of carried it, to a degree, because I think you were there in front of the camera talking about it and all those kind of things. And I think that really helped.
And it was, I'll be completely honest with you. I was pessimistic at the start. I kind of went, I can't see that.
I saw your Facebook post.
I can't see that. So, well, it's because I, on LinkedIn, I get approached by outsourcing companies
of
on
course.
A weekly basis. But it seemed a strange thing to do at the time, right? Because of the competition in the marketplace. But when you take a step back and talk about that craftsmanship approach that we just spoke about in the previous question, it fits really well because what you did was simply an extension of what you'd learned in the previous, say, 6 years, 7 years. You were applying all your knowledge from that point to launching something that wasn't, whilst it might have been a different model for what you were doing before, it wasn't radically different.
No.
I think that's where now I look back on it and go, actually, that was a pretty sensible decision at the time. So how did you sort of scale it so quickly and effectively? Because it did sort of go from, zero to hero quite quickly.
I think it was a combination of the previous years of coaching as well as, on the court with staff, doing a lot of reflection on the process. I call it the growth paradox. And I created this concept called the growth paradox, which is the thing that most business owners strive to achieve is the very thing that holds them back. And that is, there's this hero culture, or this kind of rock star culture around fast growth and fast growth fundamentally. And I'm sure you see it too, Simon, when it comes to from a marketing perspective, as far as business owners are like, okay, what's going to solve all their problems? There's more leads, more inquiries. It's going to solve all their problems. Except the business isn't ready for that. It's not ready to scale. The product delivery systems aren't in place. There's no sales process in place. And so this growth paradox model is kind of a process of scaling a business smoothly. And I think I've got this personal mission to shift the focus of this rock star status from fast, massive growth to smooth, massive growth. And it might take a little longer, but you'll experience more of an S curve, but it'll be sustainable. And so to answer your question, everything that we did at StaffBearer, everything was, can this scale globally? Yeah. Is it world-class?
Yeah.
That's pretty much the two questions. Yeah. Can it scale globally? Is it world-class? And what I mean by world-class was more so the branding, and can it scale globally was more of the systems. And when I say branding, I mean culture. Yeah. Culture, and as I'm sure you profess, there needs to be alignment with internal culture, with the external branding.
I think you talk about that branding, one of the things you said earlier on is about it was fun. You want it to be bright and fun. And I've just literally, as I was driving in this morning, listening to Richard Branson talk about the launch of Virgin Atlantic all those years ago, when he took on British Airways from the sort of London to New York route. And he said, I wanted it to be fun. He said, obviously, airlines and airline safety are serious things, but that doesn't mean to say you can't have fun and there can't be humor in there as well. So
100%. One of the best books I've ever read, and it's interesting because I don't profess to be a marketer. I do enjoy marketing. I love the psychology of marketing. That's why I love listening to this podcast, Simon. Oh dear. The was The Hero and the Outlaw.
Yeah.
Which are on archetypes. And I did a little bit of work with a company in Brisbane through another company I was associated with, and they did some archetyping for their rebrand. And it was, it spoke to me that an organization has personality. And we built StaffBearer around the Jester archetype. That was just, something that we lived and breathed. Both Jess and I have fun. We enjoy having fun. And we're like, that's going to be an expression of that through the... And that's what's going to have us stand out. We are still professional, still smooth, but we need to make sure that it's different. And no offense to accountants and lawyers that have set up offshore teams or outsourcing companies over there, but you could just tell that every other company was set up by an accountant or a lawyer that thought this was a great idea, and then they just applied the same, the same structure to and the same brand type, greys and blues and boring and
Yeah, I I hear. What did you, yeah. In terms of, so you've talked a little bit about the brand, but was there some specific marketing that you did that you found gave you better results than other channels?
Strategic alliances.
Okay.
I mean, I know that's not a digital.
I mean, that's. I always talk about partnerships and building partnerships with business owners and saying that that's always a great opportunity. So, give me an example of one of those, of how that worked and how it benefited you.
Yeah, well, one of the things we decided was, and this was a reflection again of our process up until this point, was that people, we launched the company based on my existing clients through the coaching space. And it was a very easy transition for them, almost like here's another tool or a resource to help you achieve your objectives. And the transaction was smooth because there was so much trust and credibility and relatedness and intimacy there with the business owner. And so when I, because there was a trusted advisor, when I made the recommendation of, hey, look, take it or leave it, but this is where I see this is going to make a massive difference, it was a smooth transaction. And so that got us thinking about, well, other business coaches and other coaching firms. And I created a strategy around connecting with, and we launched this in the States as well as in Australia, about building relationships digitally. So not just on LinkedIn with the connection that you mentioned that you get two or three a week from.
Yeah.
Hey, noticed your profile and I've been reading it and I think none of that. But more so engagement. So, we set up a platform and we created a team in the Philippines to really start to engage in and just get noticed with these strategic partners. We had our top 30 and we'd always target those. We'd always have 30 on the go. We wouldn't have any more, any less. And it was a matter of, okay, how are we going to build engagement or get noticed by these particular influencers? Whether it was engaging on and genuine engagement, not like nice post or random kind of no-brainer engagements. I mean genuine engagement. So we spent a lot of time training. I did some of the engagement myself, on my phone. If I ever had a spare time, I'd sit there, and we used a platform called Hootsuite to manage our streams, and based on certain hashtags and based on, and certain pages. We create a deck of all of our strategic partners, their Facebook pages, their Instagram pages, and every day we would engage in their posts until we got noticed, and then it was a matter of kind of taking that, transitioning from that digital space into the real world and making the connection. So I'd literally pick up the phone and say, hey, I'm the CEO of a company called Staffberry. You may have heard of us. And they're like, yes, we have. Love your stuff. We love your brand. Look, we thought it'd be interesting catching up for a coffee or a Skype chat or depending on where they were.
Go on.
Yeah, worked exceptionally well. Just worked exceptionally well.
I think you've said something there that sort of really resonated those four words that pick up the phone.
Yeah, pick up the phone.
And I had a conversation with a small business owner probably 8 weeks ago. And I said to her at the time, I said, you need to call people. I said, you need to call people, introduce yourself, send them information. You can send them emails, but send them emails after you've called them and build a relationship with these people. And because she was looking for people to potentially sell her products, distributors, those kind of things. And I said, they need an emotional connection with you. They need to know who you are. They need to understand, they'd be able to trust you and so on and so forth. And the easiest way of doing that is calling them. You can post 1,000 times on LinkedIn, but it's not going to get anywhere close to actually having a conversation with them. And someone else actually yesterday on LinkedIn, a recruiter, said the same thing. He said he gets 100 pitch emails a day and he gets one phone call a day and he takes the phone call.
100%. It's people are afraid of the phone. People are afraid of the rejection. And I've said this, I don't know whether I've said this to you before, Simon, but I've said it to other people. I think, selling cars, especially used cars, which probably, I think it should be like conscription for small business owners. I think everyone should do 12 months of selling used cars.
You're right. Everybody should learn to sell. I sold beer, which some would argue is the easiest thing to sell in the world. And a lot of the time it was. But there was also a lot of time where you were walking into a suburban pub where there was three guys sitting in there and you thought, you know, I'm going to be lucky to get out of here alive. And you were a, you know, fresh-faced 23-year-old and going, this guy's been in the pub business for 30 years and he's got love and hate tattooed on his knuckles. And I've got to convince him to change one of the taps that all his regulars like one of my taps. And honestly, that's a sharp learning curve about how to sell. There is
100%.
You learn in 5 minutes there because he has to like you in 5 minutes. And you got a shirt and tie on, and he's got tattoos and a singlet. And you're right. And every business owner should go and do that because that's a
Look, it makes you, it thickens the skin. It makes you resilient, and it has you, you know. I think that's probably resilience is the key. It's that ability to be able to, you know, to get a punch, a metaphorical punch to the face.
Yes,
and just go, you know what? Okay, cool. What did I learn from that? Yeah. Let's get up. Let's go again. And
I said to the business owner, that one 8 weeks ago, 6 weeks ago, whatever it was, and I said to her, you know, you're probably going to get rejected 19 times, and then the 20th time, you might get someone who's interested, but my God, it's going to take some fortitude for you to get through those 19 phone calls and be rejected or not even get through to the person you want to talk to.
Yeah, totally. And I think, look, one of the biggest, for those that are listening that are like, okay, well, yes, that sounds great. I'm prepared to do it, but how? I think just be yourself too. Be authentic. I know I'm guilty of in the past, you know, writing sales scripts and phone scripts and things like that. One of the things that I would always say then, but I'm going to drive it home even more now is, you know, I'm going to say be yourself, but there's a caveat to it. Because if you need to sell to someone that's not like you, then you obviously need to relate at some level. But be authentic, be real. You don't have to have it all polished. Have an idea of what you want to say, but just get on the phone and be you.
On that note, if people listening are starting a business or they've been running a business for a long time, what are the three top things that you say to people, here's what you should be doing? Or things that they should be changed, you know, those kind of behaviors that you think that's important for people to actually work on themselves?
I think start a journey of self-discovery, you know, look at what your strengths, like do the work. And I say the work, I mean, I know that's kind of out of context since kind of how I refer to it, but, you know, immerse yourself in books that are going to make you a better human being. And what I mean by that is have a look at what are the limiting beliefs that you have about yourself. It kind of goes back to what we talked about before earlier in the podcast is, you know, be self-aware. And I know Gary Vee talks about it a lot, be self-aware. Yeah. And I'm not sure whether people get access to it just by saying it over and over again, but like start to have a look at, just get first and foremost that, you know, every opinion that you formulated about yourself was at some point made up. And you didn't come out, you weren't born with, you know, these preconceived notions about yourself. And we start to formulate those once you get language and you get told certain things and they become the truth. I think for a business owner, it's as much of a personal game as you know, and we both know, it's that personal strength, that internal strength, that will set you through. Ego and identity will only get you so far. So first thing would be just to really immerse yourself in discovering who you are and learning, you know, more about yourself. What else? Three things.
Put you on the spot there.
Three. I know. Learn how to be great with people. I think that's learn how to be great with people. And I think what people find is that the more they do the work on themselves as far as discovering who they really are, they have this genuine, like there's a direct correlation then with others. I think the more people remove ego and identity and what shows up then is a kind of a natural expression to contribute and make a difference, and it's a natural love for people, which makes the, you know, being great with people a lot easier if you've done the work on yourself. You know, if you've got, you know, self-love, you know, love for others comes kind of naturally. So I think that's the would be the next point. And you're going to love this, but learn marketing. Yeah. I'm not saying this to piss in your pocket, but actually do, you know, get that. And I suppose it ties in there too, is when you have a love for others, especially your team internally, you'll start to build and create a culture internally that makes it, that that is real, that has substance to it. And you're not going to build a business successfully. You're not going to scale a business as much as you might be there. And I think this is one of the biggest kind of reality checks that the driven, like I was back in the day, like this driven ego, you know, give it to me, get out of the way, let me do it, let me show you how good I am, let's drive out a result. But the biggest reality check that I got, and I see it in coaching clients, is that they can't do it all themselves. It's going to come a time where, you know, the amount of hours you have in the day and the amount of energy you have in a day is going to be limited. So you're going to need to empower other people and build a team and build a culture. And I think, you know, if you can get the concept that, you know, it's not words on a wall, it's not, you know, a mission statement or a vision statement, it's who you're being, like who you actually are as the CEO, as the founder. If you can get that, and you can work with a marketing agency or whatever it might be, where you can then transition that core belief or that core set of values into a brand, so that there's alignment then externally as well as internally. Dude, the sky's the limit. You'll scale smoothly. I mean, obviously you need the systems in place to back it up, but you've got that culture right. So
fantastic three pieces, and you sounded like you were going to struggle there, but they were three awesome pieces of advice. Last few questions. These are probably hopefully a little bit more easier. Books that you'd recommend, or a book that you've read that you would go, you know what, if I'm in business, you should be reading this.
Yeah. So I think it depends on where you're at in your business journey. I think if you're starting out, The E-Myth Revisited by Michael Gerber. I know I referenced that before. It's an oldie but a goodie. And I think, you know, there's a lot more sexier books out there these days. But as far as the crux of starting a business and you know, the E doesn't stand for, you know, I thought it was like a digital kind of, you know, E stands for entrepreneurial. Yeah. So the entrepreneurial myth is what it refers to. And it's a great, fantastic core small business book, and talks about the process of systemizing a business and, you know, not taking an idea and it's told in parable format as well, parts of it anyway. So kind of this beautiful swing between parable and then textbook. So that would be that. If you're a bit further on, I would say if you haven't read Scaling Up by Vern Harnish.
That's on my list actually. Yeah.
You need to. Yeah. It's a textbook for bigger, smaller businesses to medium-sized companies. And I mean a textbook. It's something that you want to, that I do and still do and did with Staffberry. We built Staffberry based on the E-Myth. We used that as our reference. It's a great all-round book. And then depending on, I think that's probably the two. Other than that, anything from Jim Collins, if you're, you know, bigger again, anything from Jim Collins, Good to Great, Built to Last, any of that. But it really, just immerse yourself in books. I think, I mean, I read an average of two books a month. Sometimes more at the moment. audio books, if you're not a big reader or you fall asleep, you know, just constantly have something on and you'll find you know.
Again, there's a, I don't know, I'm going to forget where I read this, but it was saying that in terms of your personal growth, your personal investment, because, you know, the stock market is so flat at the moment and, you know, finding a decent return on investing your money is a struggle. They said that, you know, buying a $20 book or a $10 book, $10 audio book or whatever is perhaps to help you and then develop you is perhaps one of the best financial investments that you can make at the moment. You know, for $20 and a few days of your life to start developing yourself using that money, that's, you know, better and, or, you know, as good as investing in stocks and shares and things like that. So...
Especially in business, you know, especially in business. I mean, it could be just that one thing, and you'll read books that you don't relate to, and then you'll find authors that you do. And, you know, I think if I could actually add a fourth point to those three points before, the love of learning is probably one of the keys to success in business, because you don't have the answers, and I don't profess to have the answers. I'm constantly, you know, taking new things on. So, yeah, I just immerse yourself in learning. But I'm going to say one point. don't use that as an excuse to not take action, though. You know, like, don't use that as an excuse to say, oh, I don't have all the answers, or I'm not quite ready yet. That's BS. It's an on the court, as lived kind of type of learning.
Yeah. Okay. Last couple of questions then. Brands that you like, and you can't say Staffbury, and you can't say you can't say your clothing company and all those kind of things. What draws you to brands? What draws you to products, and you know, something that you buy all the time?
Jester brands. Okay. You know, like I like I mean, you know this about me. I like satire. I like things that take the piss out of themselves and out of industries. Yeah. You know, I did have one of the brands I liked earlier, well, not when say early on, but you know, a little while ago, probably last year, the year before, was iSelect. It was a great, I liked the brand, I liked the marketing behind it, like the message. I didn't necessarily use them, but you know, it was something that was memorable. I think, what was that? There was a small finance company as well. I can't remember what their name was, which is probably not a good sign for their brand.
Obviously had a huge
obviously
impact
didn't stick.
It,
yeah. A massive impact. But then all, I mean, and then like Virgin is a brand that I admire. I think, you know, it's a great example of taking someone's personality of, you know, Richard Branson's personality and infusing it across so many different channels. I think it's, I don't know whether they studied it at marketing school, but, you know, it's consistent. Yeah. And that is a brand that I do use. It's consistent across, you know, my customer experience as well for most part.
Yeah. Yeah. So what's next for Simon Bell? Where does he go from here?
Yeah, good question. No, I'm going to take some time off, I think, and just spend it with the family. So since the exit, it's been an opportunity to catch up and just reflect and kind of plan my next move. So I don't have anything set in stone yet.
Which actually, sorry, and I'm going to have to go back here because what we didn't cover is a quick how and why you exited. Because I think that's important for people to understand that you'd been there for three years, and the catalyst for you to exit was, you know, give us a quick kind of explanation of that.
Yeah, well, the business was always designed, like from the very day we launched it, it was designed to be sold, and I think. Yeah, it was always going to be a 5-year plan, and which was June 19. Or thereabouts, so 5 years-ish. Yeah. And then look at an opportunity, my business partner and some colleagues of hers presented an opportunity to me. They wanted to invest some more capital into the business and really amp it up. And there was an opportunity for me to sell my shares fundamentally. Yeah. And it was a great experience to support Jess in the transition and the opportunity to exit was there. And so I thought, well, carpe diem.
And I think this was the whole thing that fascinates me about that story was that it was built to sell, which I don't think a lot of people think about. People don't sort of go, you know what, let's build something that's deliberately, we're deliberately building it and to sell it. And I think, so that was one thing. I think the second thing was that it was done within 3 years. And I think I've seen startups that I've known for 5 years, 7 years, longer than that. And they still seem to me to be no further forward than they were when they started. And it seems to be this kind of monumental struggle for a lot of startups where you've very much sort of turned that on its head and gone day one to, you know, 3 years, bang, sold out, you know, and you may now, you've got that experience, go, oh, you know, I might do that again. But it's that 3-year story that I think is fascinating. And I think people should think about that as a goal and go, where's the exit? And I'm sure you say that with when you sort of do coach from a business perspective, that people should know how to get out.
Definitely. Begin with the end in mind. I mean, it's an oldie but a goodie. And it's interesting. It almost, and I know it did for me in the early stages, not at all now, and it hasn't probably for the last, well, since we launched Staffbury. It does seem paradoxical to think about selling a business before you even start one. And especially in Australian culture too, it's, you know, there's almost that, you know, let's not put the horse before the cart, or let's not, you know, let's not, you know, think too big. But no, look, if you, I relate to business as an ability to express who I am, and more of an art form, so to speak, than a science. Although there's a balance of that science and art, but express who I am to, but then also there's that element of the investment aspect of it, no different to buying a house and doing it up and then selling it. There is that ability, or build a house and sell it. The beautiful part about business as opposed to real estate is that, yes, there's some capital investiture, but you get to make this from nothing. You know, you have the opportunity to build something from nothing as opposed to...
Yeah. And I think if you keep that in mind, I think if people keep that in mind that the business is going to be sold, or it's being built with an intention of being sold, and even if you don't sell it, even if you sit there and go, well, I'm going to be in it for 10 to 20 years, whatever. But if you consistently think about it as a product that you're going to sell, then you can't help but go, right, well, it needs to be profitable. It needs to be cash flow positive. It needs to be have a good culture and a good brand and all those kind of things. If you're constantly thinking that next week you might sell it, you have to make sure those things are all right, because that's what inevitably drives the value in the business. You know, people buy businesses because they're profitable, because the cash flow is good, because the brand's good, because there's an opportunity to scale it, all those kind of things. So, you know, I think if people keep that in mind, then they're going to perform a lot better than if they're just, you know, there's no kind of end goal in mind.
100%. 100% agree. 100%. Yep.
Last question. Where can people find you and get in contact with you? So let's say if someone wants to offer you a fantastic job. do you think you could go and work for someone now?
No.
Nobody email Simon and offer him a job. Okay, don't do that.
No.
Offer him, you know, investment in his next project, absolutely, but don't email him and offer him.
Totally.
Where can they find you?
LinkedIn is probably the best place to find me at the moment. So,
are there many Simon Bells out there? There's not many Simon Dells, but are there many Simon Bells?
I don't actually know. I haven't. I mean, I can't get the simonbell.com.au because it's owned by somebody. Oh. So there's at least one Simon Bell out there that's making life a little bit more challenging
Bastard.
For me. I know. But yeah, LinkedIn. I'm more than happy to connect with anybody on LinkedIn.
Awesome. Mate, I don't think we've ever had a boring conversation.
No.
I don't think we've ever had a conversation that I haven't enjoyed. And this one included. So just want to thank you very much for your time. Really appreciate that. I know you've got a bit of time on your hand, but thank you very much. You're actually the second person I've interviewed that's out of a job at the moment.
Fun employed.
So maybe it's a common theme with people coming on this podcast. So thank you very much once again.
You're welcome, Simon. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
We've come to the end of the episode, episode 3, Simon Dell podcast. So thank you very much for joining us. I'm just going to finish up with my tip, trick, or feature that I've seen this week that I think you will all enjoy and find useful. This week, I'm going to review something called Instapaper. Now, Instapaper is a tool that I use as a Chrome plugin to actually save articles and websites and all those kind of bits and pieces that I think I'll find and need useful, will find useful later on. Now, so I use it primarily as a bookmarking tool, but the idea being is that it generates a easier read version of the article, and that you can review that later on, and you know, in the same way that you'd review a newspaper, hence the name Instapaper. I thoroughly recommend it if you're one of those people that finds a lot of articles that you think you're going to need later on for your business or personal, whatever. Get the Chrome plugin, punch the little I button that's next to the address bar, and it will save it to your Instapaper account. And you can then review that on your mobile, iPad, laptop, desktop, whatever you want. I find it very useful. I've got absolutely hundreds of articles now saved in there. So I thoroughly recommend it. So that's my tip and hint for this week. Please remember, if you get an opportunity to review us on iTunes or Android store, try and give us 5 stars and tell us how wonderful we are, please. If you'd like to get in contact with me, my website is simondell.com. My email is simon@simondell.com. Twitter, I am Simon Dell. That's I am in front of my name. And recently we just launched the podcast Instagram. So that's easy to find. That's the Simon Dell Podcast. And you'll find many of the things that we've spoken about in this episode actually on the Instagram. So some of the adverts and some of the visual elements that we've discussed. Finally, huge credit to my sound engineer and producer, Gilberto. You can find him at welovesound.audio. Very, very helpful, knowledgeable person. If you need anything done with audio and sound, he is your man. Please make sure that you subscribe, keep in touch with us, send us any questions that you've got, and look forward to you joining us in the next episode. Thank you.